But once a year, all the ants will fly in from Utah, and I always get recruited to drive them around San Francisco to go shopping and then take them to lunch at the Cheesecake Factory. They love the Cheesecake Factory. So inevitably, we'll be sitting there at the Cheesecake Factory, and I'll look over my menu, and Aunt Mimi will be looking at me with this look. What? I just feel really bad for you. Why? Because of your lifestyle, you will never get to experience God's greatest miracle to heterosexuals. I say, what are you talking about? I'm in the Cheesecake Factory, aren't I?
Hello, and welcome to Out in the Bay, our weekly show about gay life in San Francisco and beyond. I'm Marilyn Pittman. He's been a member of the Groundlings, a lawyer, a journalist, and a dot-com magazine editor. Now he's a writer and solo performer. His show, Seven Sins, has toured Canada and the U.S. James Judd, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
So tell me, let's start with the Groundlings, just because I think that's amazing. You were in the Groundlings in L.A.
Yeah, in the early 90s.
And you were performing with Kathy Griffin.
Kathy Griffin, Lisa Kudrow. People like Phil Hartman, Pee Wee Herman, they had just sort of left, and it was right before, say, the Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry years. It was kind of like a dark period for the company. I kind of fell into the dark hole of the Groundlings.
You were the only person who had a full-time job, and was, everybody else was working in the business, right?
It's true. Everybody else spent their entire days doing commercial auditions. And I worked for AT&T. I was an account executive in the major markets group in downtown Los Angeles. I actually didn't do anything. I just sat there and pretended to do things. I got away with it for a whole year without ever really knowing what my job was. It was just kind of lost in the masses.
But by the end of the day, no supervisor, no anybody comes by. By the end of the first week, I begin to think they've forgotten me. By the end of the second week, I get my first paycheck, and I think, I have so found the perfect job for me!
And so I could never rehearse with anybody at the Groundlings. All I could do was monologues about how much I hated working in a cubicle. Well, one day there was a manager in the audience, and she said, I heard one of my little monologues about working in a cubicle. She said, make this into a three-minute stand-up, and I'll get you an audition at the Improv. Santa Monica Improv, I did it. Afterwards, the owner, Mark Lanau, said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to put you in the Monday night lineup of the new faces at the Hollywood Improv. And my first spot was 11 o'clock on a Monday. So I'm ready to go, and just before I go on, someone says, Jerry's here, which meaning Jerry Seinfeld, and he wants to do some stuff. And this was during the time of Seinfeld when Jerry would do those little comedy bits at the beginning of each show. Okay, so he would come on Monday nights and practice whatever they'd written that day in the writer's room in front of an audience.
Right.
So there's like,
that's the old Marx Brothers idea.
Exactly. So there were a couple people left in the room, and because they're really excited to see Jerry Seinfeld, and he comes in, and of course the comedy is related to whatever the script was, and the audience doesn't know that, so the jokes bombed. So when Jerry Seinfeld bombs, at 11:20, that's pretty much the end of the night.
So pack it up,
everybody's getting up and they're like stirring. Someone's like, and now James Judd, and there's like a little clapping, and there's just, you could hear the scraping of chairs as I sort of had to say excuse me through the crowd of people leaving the stage to get up on stage. But he tried to call me, actually started introducing me as the new Paul Lynde, which I didn't want that label at all. I really didn't. I thought, well, this is really going to hold me back. I don't want to be compared to Paul Lynde. Not that many people know who he is that are in the audience in Santa Monica Improv. So I've asked him to stop doing it. Now, the Toronto Star, in reviewing Seven Sins, called me Paul Lynde for the new millennium, and it splashed all over my posters. I'm thrilled. I'll take it.
So now
I love it. It's a tremendous compliment.
Well, that's how times have changed as well.
Yeah.
Were you ever in the closet in your performances?
No, I was just me.
You.
But the thing was is that at the time, I was in a very happy relationship, so there was nothing to complain about for me. I only wanted to talk about how much I hated working in a cubicle, and that was something that the audience could really relate to.
Please hold. Then I put them on hold, and I press transfer star, transfer, and boom, they're gone. I don't know where those calls go, but they don't come back to me. Well, when I got back to my cubicle, I had some good news, bad news of my own. The bad news was that the man from personnel was there to tell me that I was terminated, effective immediately. Good news, the pink slip came made out to Gary, while automatic check deposits to James continued for another year.
It finally came to a head where one club, the Ice House, said, "You're too gay to be in our lineup. Too light in the loafers." That was the expression.
Light in the loafers, right, in Pasadena.
And then immediately after that, Comedy Central decided they were going to do their very first gay comedy special.
What year was that?
I would say early 93, maybe.
Really?
94, because it was close to the time that I decided to get out. And they came, they saw me, and at a Star Search audition, which I ended up getting on Star Search, they cast me in this gay comedy thing. I was the very first person who was cast in this. And then about 2 weeks before taping, they said, "You're out," because I wasn't gay enough.
What does that mean, gay enough, James?
I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, you're not being gay enough. I mean, how much
apparently
more?
Not.
Well, I think in the early days of this, you know, they wanted that stereotype. I think they still do.
I knew eventually. I just had to get out. I just couldn't adjust to the stand-up comedy lifestyle. And one year I was booked
insane
in Las Vegas. I thought, "Oh, I'm in Las Vegas. I've really made it." It was rodeo week. It was the worst thing ever. I mean, I was just a drift in it. No, not the gay rodeo. No, the straight rodeo, the regular rodeo. I was like the comic for the rodeo. I mean, who got my great gig at the Liberace convention? That's what I want to know. It wasn't the right mix. I knew I had to get out. So I moved to New Hampshire and became a criminal defense attorney.
Really?
I did.
You did?
I did. And you know what? I have gotten someone out of jail by making the prosecutor laugh after work. After court hours. So you never know where it's going to come in handy.
Well, now you're doing Seven Sins.
This is one of the main stories in the show. It's about how I attempted to win my fifth grade book report competition by you bringing in my search for Patty Hearst, and it really didn't go well.
It was 1975, the first Tuesday in June, otherwise known as the semifinals of the Foothill Elementary School fifth grade book report competition.
Woo!
And I am this close to being named top fifth grade book reporter. Here's how it works. One student from each of the six fifth grade classrooms will be chosen to compete in front of a school-wide assembly for the title of top fifth grade book reporter. I know, it's huge! Now, picture me at 10 years old. I stand 5'9" tall. I have a huge head of curly brown hair. I'm not popular at all. I couldn't be less popular. I'm just, you know, a total nerd. But I have convinced myself that if I can win this competition, if I can get into the finals, I'll become completely popular. So, let's say I'm in the cafeteria and I've got my tray. Now, when I say go, I want some people over here to say, you know, congratulations, James, when I say go, okay? So here I'm, I've got my tray, I'm in the cafeteria. Go, go. Oh my gosh, thanks! Now, there is just one thing or one person standing between me and the way of victory, and her name is Mary Ann Applebaum. Mary Ann Applebaum is in my class, which means I gotta beat her in order to get to the finals. And Mary Ann is the second most popular girl in the whole school. Felicia Johnson is the most popular girl. She already has boobs, but Mary Ann is number two. And Mary Ann is, you know, she's cute and she's funny and she's smart and she's a teacher's pet. And everybody likes her and they're like, "Oh, Mary Ann, you're so nice. And oh, Mary Ann, can you come to my party? And oh, Mary Ann, can I sit next to you at lunch? And oh, Mary Ann, I like you so much. And oh, just hate her. I hate her." Marianne wants to be book report champion in the worst way. I mean, she pretends she doesn't care. She's like, "I don't care, but I know she wants it." I see her for what she really is, a ruthless competitor. She's like the Tara Lipinski of fifth grade book report. On the outside, she's all smiles and let me entertain you, but inside, she's rotten to the core. Now, This thing is going to be won by whichever one of us has picked the hardest book. I don't know what book she's picked. She doesn't know what book I picked, but I'm dying to know. So at this point, everyone else in the class has already, you know, taken a shot at this thing, but we all know it's between me and Marianne. And then suddenly Mrs. Schusong, our teacher, calls Marianne to the front of the room, and she gets up, laughing at her friend. Let me just tell you something. 4 years from now, 4 years to the day, she would audition to represent Santa Clara County in the Miss Teen USA pageant, and she would not make it, and it would nearly kill her. But today she's on kind of a roll. Hi, my name is Marianne Applebaum. And the book I have chosen for today's semifinals at the fifth grade book report competition is Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. It's a really good book. Yes, I want to shout, I got you. I totally got you. I mean, okay, Little Women is a big book, especially for the fifth grade. I mean, most people are reading Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. But I want to say, come on, people, it's canned ham. Someone does it every year. Don't you see? She's just cute. She doesn't have any real talent. She probably saw the movie. Now, I know that I am not cute and funny and smart and pretty and popular like Marianne Applebaum. So if I'm going to win this thing, I need a book that's really big, a book that's really just going to put me over the edge, something, you know, gritty, something ripped from the headlines. So the book I've chosen is My Search for Patty Hearst.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is James Judd. His solo comedy show, Seven Sins, plays weekends at the Exit Theater in San Francisco from May 30th through June 21st. Don't miss it. For tickets, you can go to theaterbayarea.org, or for more info, go to sffringe.org. You're pretty precocious and smart as a kid, huh?
I thought it was, you know, a natural read. I mean, everybody was talking about it. It was all anybody was talking about. I grew up in Saratoga, California, which is, you know,
the
about
peninsula
45.
Here.
Yeah, so it seemed like it was, you know, right here in the neighborhood. I was absolutely obsessed with it.
Well, it was in our neighborhood here. I mean,
it was the most exciting thing ever.
It was.
I was certain that I was going to see her. I mean, I was looking for her all the time. And it just didn't occur to me that all the other kids weren't also looking for Patty Hearst.
And your parents let you come to San Francisco on your own at that age? Or how did you think you were going to see her?
Actually, well, you know, by the time I was 13, I was taking a bus and a train into San Francisco to take classes with the ACT Young Conservatory by myself. And then I would get back on the bus, go to the train station,
get on
another bus in Sunnyvale and take the bus home. My parents thought that was fine. Today, you know, it's hard to imagine letting a 13-year-old do that.
But, I suppose. So you got to San Francisco and were looking around for Patty Hearst.
Yeah, all the way up and down between San Francisco and Saratoga.
Well, let's let the story continue.
It's not a completely random choice. I've been obsessed with the missing heiress since she was kidnapped. Well, suddenly, Marianne is done, and she's getting lots of calls, and she's sitting down, and Miss Husong calls my name, and now I'm very nervous. And I come up to the front of the room, but just then, a teacher from another classroom walks in, and Mrs. Husong, my teacher, is called out to a conference, and she says, "Go on, James, just get started without me, you know, blah, blah, blah." So I just jump right in. I say, "How many people here have ever been kidnapped?" Nobody raises their hand. So I say, "How many people here have ever been locked in a closet?" Yeah, a couple of people. So by the time Mrs. Husong comes back in the room, I've already drawn a number of pictures on the board, including all the major names of the Symphonies Liberation Army, the SLA, the group that kidnapped Patty, Donald DeFreeze, Nancy Lee Perry, Bill and Emily Harris, you know the rest. Over here I have a seven-headed snake, which is the group's trademark and frequent backdrop for publicity photos. Over here is a drawing of the Hibernia Bank, where Patty reintroduced herself to the world as a terrorist, and a stick figure of Patty as she appeared that day as Tanya, a tough chick bank robber with a weighty curl. So Miss Husong comes back in the room, and she looks at the pictures, and she's kind of confused for a minute by the, you know, what are the pictures and by the silence, because at that moment I was having everybody write their own ransom notes.
What an imagination.
Yeah, but you know, when they caught her, she was still kind of in the area, wasn't she? I mean, many times when Brownie and I, my miniature dogs, and we would scour the neighborhood looking for clues, I mean, we were right on her tail. But what the thing was is that I didn't plan to turn her in. I was going to join.
You wanted to run away?
Yeah, I wanted to be part of the SLA. I wanted to just have my picture taken in front of that seven-headed snake and have it plastered all over the place. An early quest to be in the spotlight, I guess.
Were your parents tolerant of did they know about all this?
Listen, part of my book report, I took a black sock and I tied it around the title, kind of like a blindfold. I mean, the sock thing was my mother's idea.
Your mother's idea?
Yeah, she was like, oh, this will be great. You know, my mother was, I come from a little bit of a strange family. My father, when my parents met, my father was a missionary from Utah. My mother was a cocktail waitress from Las Vegas. So I like to tell people I was really the only hard-drinking Mormon in kindergarten who could shoot craps.
Who could shoot craps?
Yeah. So yeah, they were very theatrical. My father was also a ventriloquist, so they were. I came from a very theatrical family. They are a family that could appreciate a good bit.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you're so obviously talented and precocious at such a young age. I mean, you're just definitely full of yourself. It's
yeah,
a
you
very
had to be entertaining
story.
At the dinner table in our house. You had to be able to tell a good story.
And that parlays into the show Seven Sins. Let's listen more.
And she said, James, what book are you reading? And I tell her, and she flips. She said, that is completely inappropriate material for the fifth grade. Sit down. I know. Now I know. Now I know that what I said next was wrong. I know that now. But you have to admire my commitment to the moment when, as a 10-year-old, I turned to my teacher and I said, oh, yeah? Well, maybe I should lock you in the supply closet for a month and you start to see things my way. Power to the people! Rise up! I revolutionary brothers and sisters!
You were just having a patty time, weren't you?
It was great,
and
you know. And now she raises champion dogs. She had a,
and
she
does
had a
John
beagle.
Waters movies, which I just think she's so fantastic. Every time I see her in a John Waters movie,
it's bizarre.
It's very fun how he.
So
puts
I know
her in
that
movies.
I'm not alone. There were others out there.
Oh, it captured the imagination, but I had not thought about it capturing the imagination of a small guy, a small boy.
I wish
boy.
She would show up at one of my shows. It'd be so exciting. If you're listening, Patty, it's a free ticket waiting for you at the door.
I don't think she needs it, but that's very gracious of you. Let's listen to a little bit more. This is from Seven Sins. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is James Judd. His show, Seven Sins, is at Theater Rhino Fridays and Saturdays in April. You can find out more at therhino.org.
So now I'm in the front seat of my mother's 75 Granada, having been sent home for the day for insubordination. And my mother is livid, having been called away from her job at IBM, where she's becoming something of an expert in the hot new field of word processing. But she's in no position to punish me because, you know what, she gave me the book, and the black sock thing was actually her idea. So she pulls the car into the driveway, and she grabs my arm as I'm getting out, and she says, just a minute. Since you're so good at remembering people's names and all the terrible things they do, I have a little job for you this afternoon. You do it, and I won't tell your father what happened. Well, you have to understand, I come from a strange family. When my parents met, my father was a missionary from Utah, and my mother was a cocktail waitress from Las Vegas. I like to tell people I was the only hard-drinking Mormon in kindergarten who could shoot craps. So I said, okay, what is it? She said, I want you to watch The Young and the Restless for me and tell me what happens. It comes on at 2 at Channel 5. Now, you do it, and this will be our little secret. So I did it, and wow, what an eye-opener.
So there's the story again.
Look, I know, I'm doing my bits.
Doing your bits, and then we're listening to them. It's, you know, it's what happens when you're a solo performer. You're very, it's self-absorbing to be a solo performer. You know,
what are you saying, I'm a narcissist?
I didn't say the N-word.
I'm not fat. I don't know, but I just
where
felt
does that
there was
come
some
from?
Sort of
where's the fat
allusion to
from?
Being self-absorbed.
So you have to be fat if you're self-absorbed?
Probably,
you
I guess.
Me?
I don't All know.
Right. That reminds me about Fat Camp. Will you tell us that story?
Yes. For my 40th birthday, I'm going to be 40 this Saturday, just not for the first time. For my first time I turned 40,
that's so gay.
My parents told me that they were giving me a vacation at a spa. that's what I thought was going to be a spa. And it turned out to be more like a lockdown fat camp in Fort Lauderdale in the middle of July. This is when that trip was. So that was a bit of a surprise. But the real surprise is when I got there, I found out that my four Mormon aunts from Utah were also there. Now, these aunts are very devout Republicans and very devout Mormons.
They had long dresses on?
They did have long dresses on.
Just like Big Love on HBO?
Absolutely.
Scary.
They're not polygamists, although my great-grandfather was a polygamist, but they do all live in Utah, and we enjoy being related to each other in a very sort of distant, never seen, speaking, or referring to each other sort of way. They all have a lot of kids between them. They have 57 grandchildren. And so we had 14 days of lockdown, calorie-free family togetherness.
14 days?
Yeah. It was tough.
That is terrible. And you didn't have any drugs to take or anything? I'm sorry.
No alcohol, no sugar, no salt, no flavor, constant forced exercise.
So you had to be in touch with all your feelings. Because that's what it does. You take all the other substances and all of a sudden all your feelings come up and your feelings of intense hatred, no.
Yeah, it really wears you down. It really does. But they came there with an agenda, which was to make sure that I understand that I am the last remaining male member of the Judd family. And when I die, the Judd family name goes with me. So they would be after me. When are you going to have a baby? When are you going to have a baby? It wasn't so much they cared about the gay thing, because they would say, don't you and your Spanish friend want to have a child? Now, Eric, my partner, is Puerto Rican and a native Spanish speaker, but they don't ever refer to him by name. They just call him my Spanish friend. And I don't care. His family calls me El Gigante Blanco, the white giant. So all is fair. But no kids yet, as far as I know.
Torture. Let's finish and listen to the last couple of clips here of your show, clips from The Seven Sins. This is James Judd. You're listening to Out in the Bay.
Later that night, my mother came into my room and she said, well, what happened? I said, Lauren was buried alive on the eve of her wedding to Paul. Did Paul find her? Yes, but he didn't have a shovel. So he went to look for one, and he ran into Coco, who had a shovel, but told him that she was in love with him too and was planning on stopping the wedding anyway, so maybe he wanted to just leave her there. Well, what did Paul say? Well, nothing. I mean, he opened his mouth to speak and then closed it and then opened it and closed it and then the screen went to black and that was it. Now, if you ever watch soap operas, you know that this is true. Just when you finally want to hear what someone has to say, they don't say it. They open their mouth and then they close it. Open. And then the screen goes black. So my mother says, oh gosh, well, okay, you're going to have to stay home tomorrow. She says, when are you going to have a baby? Look, if I wanted a baby, I'd get a baby. Being gay is no barrier to having a child whatsoever. Are you kidding me? If I had a dollar for every single woman over 35 that tried to get sperm out of me to make a baby, I'd have $3. Well, this time, the Beijing Express 747 has got its nose pressed right up against the glass. And the first thing that I notice is that it's filthy. There's bugs all over the windshield. The second problem is that there, plainly visible on the side of the nose cone, are several large pieces of electrical masking tape, kind of, you know, like covering a gash. But that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that some of the pieces of tape appear to be peeling off. I say to my mother, I'm not getting on that plane. My mother looked at the plane, she looks at me, and she goes, how come? I said, because there is masking tape on the nose, and this thing is going to fall apart over the Pacific Ocean and take me with it. My mother says, would you please stop being such an evil queen? I say, it's drama queen. And when I was done, the judge told me to sit down again, and he said, listen, Gary, I gotta tell you, your argument is absolutely horrible, but I do have to admit that you do have some stage presence. I said, oh my gosh, thanks. Well, the end of that story was that Amy was sent to jail without bail pending trial, but well, as the bailiff was putting the handcuffs on her and wrapping it around her waist and pulling her toward the door, We shared a little moment. I said to her, hang in there, Amy, because I'm going to be with you right by your side, defending you all the way through your trial and sentencing.
That's fun. You're going to have to stay home tomorrow. Your mother's a huge influence on you.
Oh, yeah, true.
A Las Vegas cocktail waitress meets the Mormon. I mean, what an odd family.
Very strange. Yeah.
And so is she's kind of a brassy dame? Is that right? Or?
Absolutely, yes, very much so. And a bit of a stalker. She tends to, show up at different festivals where I'll be performing, and there will be Mom right in the front row.
Really?
But that's great. We like to have senior citizens in the audience. They love it.
So you're very close to your mother, like so many gay men.
Oh, yes, absolutely. To both my parents as well.
That's nice. Do you ever, do you feel like you get stereotyped? I mean, we've talked earlier about, your role as this sort of Paul Lynde character. Does that ever bother you, this sort of stereotyping of being a stereotype or filling some of those roles?
No, it doesn't anymore, because now the difference was when I was in my early 20s and I was really trying to make it as a stand-up comic, and I was touring and I was doing clubs and I did, Star Search and Evening at the Improv and Comedy on the Road and all those shows that were going on then. I was really ambitious. And now it's different because I am telling stories the way I wanted to tell them but couldn't because I was forced to do that sort of stand-up, set-up, punch routine that you have to do to work. And the stand-up comedy business is all about selling drinks. It's not about theater. So now I do it for me, and I'm very grateful for the opportunities that I have and that the people who come to see the show, and there are people who come back repeatedly to see it, and I don't care anymore if I'm performing for 10 people or 500 people. I'll do it, I'll give it my all every time I go out, and it's just really deeply satisfying. So they can put any label on me whatsoever. And I'm happy to take it as long as people will pay $10 to see me.
Is that all it costs?
Yeah. I really feel like people are afraid to see solo shows these days. My show, there's no crying, nobody dies, there's no poignancy, there are no inspirational moments whatsoever. It's just funny. There's no dancing in unitards, there's no poetry, I don't get nude, during the show. It's just funny. So I felt I had to make it cheap enough for people to take a chance. It had to be cost less than it does to go see a movie.
That's amazing, $10 for live theater. You think people are burned out on the solo show genre? Is that what you're sort of saying? I mean,
well, I think
there's so many of them.
There's a trap, where even the funny ones, they'll go along for about 15 minutes, and then the last 10 minutes before it ends, they'll try to make you cry. And it's and me as an audience member, that just makes me absolutely crazy.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining me and bringing such great clips, and good luck on your run.
At the Exit Theater, Seven Sins starring James Judd runs May 30th through June 21st at the Exit on the weekends. For more info, you can go to sffringe.org, or for tickets, theaterbayarea.org.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay, a weekly show about gay life in San Francisco and beyond. You can hear our show Thursday at 7:30 and Sunday at 2 p.m. And we archive our shows at outinthebay.com. Thanks to WY Enterprises, the fine people who do our Out in the Bay website, outinthebay.com website. They help you manage your life, your website, your office, and your personal lifestyle. You can find them at WYEnterprises.com. Write us with your comments or questions. My email is Marilyn@outinthebay.com, and Eric Jansen's, my cohort, is Eric@outinthebay.com. Thanks to Joanne Marr tonight, our engineer, and thanks to the staff and management of KALW. Out in the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me. I